I'm Laura Vinroot-Poole. For over 20 years, I've owned Capital, an internationally recognized specialty store in Charlotte, North Carolina. On this podcast, we unlock the stories of people's lives through the stories of what they wore. These aren't conversations about fashion. These are conversations about people.
Everybody wants to know her.
Marie-Helene de Tayac is a jewelry designer whose greatest love is the gemstone. From their energy to their spiritual meaning, her passion for gemstones is unbridled. On this episode, Marie-Helene shares more about her unique craft and the joy and harmony she finds through putting each piece of jewelry into the world. Marie-Helene de Tayac, I am so excited that you're here, and I don't know if you know, but in Charlotte, you've been coming for almost 20 years and you have clients and friends for 20 years here. But every few years, the clients sort of, there's this outcry that, when is Marie-Helene coming back? Can we get Marie-Helene to come back? Everybody just loves to have you here.
That's very exciting. I didn't know actually that they were all craving for me, but it's so sweet to know.
They were. They always are. But it's sort of this groundswell every few years that I think this could be the year that she'll come back. And I think that there's nothing like having you sell the jewelry. I mean, you speaking about it and you telling the stories about it is so powerful.
Jewelry is my passion. So when I speak about it, I speak about something I love. So I suppose it goes through, and you know, they get excited like I get excited, you know, when I find a new stone. It's always incredible because for me it's like a treasure hunt.
Yeah.
And I think for the collectors, the jewelry collectors, it's the same. When they find a piece which I was very excited about, they know it's a treasure hunt and they're going to find something which is so rare. And the beauty about what I do is that everything is kind of one-off.
Yes.
Because I'm dependent of what has been found on the earth. Mm-hmm. You know, it's incredible to think that the stone that I use, it takes millions of years to produce a beautiful stone. Yeah. And sometime, you know, someone will walk into my office and show me this amazing thing, that amazing stone, and I get so excited about it. And the clients are the same. You know, they know that if it's come here, it's amazing that it's come here. You know, I have a lot of clients in Japan too. And so it could have gone to another place.
Yeah.
And they want to be the first one to see it because they know they're going to find a gem.
I don't know that I loved jewelry until I met you. I mean, you changed my entire brain and my entire soul and my entire love for jewelry. You made me absolutely adore jewelry.
Thank you. When I started, I think a lot of the clients I met never wore jewelry.
Yeah.
And it was before, because it didn't fit with our life, I think. Mm-hmm. I think we're both fashion people. I love fashion, you love fashion.
Yeah.
And at the time I started jewelry, it was really minimalist. And there was nothing which would fit with my clothes, you know.
Mm.
Okay, there were great designers of the 70s, you know, I think of Elsa Peretti, which I love, and Dean Van, but nobody had stone. So I bought something which was much lighter in a way, much more désinvolte, I would say in French, to the jewelry business. And maybe that's why the clients who came were people who never even thought of looking at jewelry, because it wasn't them.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely never saw myself in jewelry until I met you.
And also, I think I'm the first generation where women are confident enough to buy their own jewelry.
Which is so unusual. I mean, that's a completely different category than ever existed before, don't you think?
Yeah, that makes a huge difference in the choice. My jewelry is very understated.
Mm.
And it's very much a personal pleasure. There's no social status attached to my work.
Yeah.
So it's very much a choice of a person for themselves. I think when men choose jewelry, very often it's to show power.
Mm.
And they want to show that they're very powerful and that their beautiful wife is wearing an amazing piece of jewelry.
That they had this job that could afford, right?
That they could afford, yes, yeah. Yes. The clients who wear my work, or the husband of the client who wear my work, they understand it's for the pleasure of every day. And when you wear a beautiful stone, I'm going back to the colored stone, which I love so much. It changes every day. It changes with the light, the daylight, the night light, the weather. It connects you constantly back to nature.
Mm.
I think for me, I always say that the gemstones are the stars of this earth. And I think we need, especially in the modern world that we live in, which is so disconnected, we need to be connected to nature. And I'm connected to nature when I have flowers, you know. Flowers, I always say that if I have TV or flowers, I watch the flowers. bird is another thing. And the other thing is a gemstone. And this is like a instant spiritual connection and a reminder that we are actually part of something much bigger and very beautiful.
That is really beautiful.
I understood this from a long time. I mean, I've been designing jewelry since 96, and I have many clients who are collectors. And I think they are a lot of the time they think my jewelry brings them good luck. But it's not to do with my jewelry. It's to do with the fact that the stones are so special. And the stone I choose, I don't choose them because they're perfect. I choose them because they are so alive.
Yeah.
And so the collectors have learned to choose the same thing. And then the collectors themselves charge them into what they believe. So I think that's what's happened with the work, because it's one of a kind. Every stone is unique. But I think the stones speak to me. They do. It's very strange. You see a packet of stone and why you're instantly attracted to one more than another.
Yeah.
But I also see it with the collectors. They will see certain amount of stone and there will be one which will be just perfect for them.
Yeah.
But this is why I did the book. I don't know if you remember a long time ago I did with Colette in 2000. Mm-hmm. We did something which we called the Precious Bar.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
We had, it was downstairs.
It was so beautiful.
And we had, and I had every single possible color of gemstone. Mm-hmm. And then I had done this little book, which
I have it.
which it actually gave the, what would you say, the properties or the powers of the stone.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that I decided to do because when I knew my client very well, I knew that they would always choose a stone related to their emotional state.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, I mean, it was incredible. Someone who was depressed would choose a smoky quartz, which lifts you out of depression. Someone who had a different childhood would choose a rose quartz. Someone who wanted to get pregnant would be attracted to a flower opal. So every time I had the time to actually, talk with them and understand what was going on in their private life, I would realize that their choice matches what were their emotional state.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided to do this book and we did this project with Colette. And then to my horror, people did the reverse. They took the book, looked at the power of the stone.
And chose that way.
And chose that way. Well, in fact, what I found interesting is that instinctively, we know what's going to help us feel better. So anyway, so I stop and I never talk about the power of the stone anymore, because I think at the end of the day, people should choose. And and what's interesting is that they choose what works for them.
When I was pregnant with my daughter, you chose the most beautiful, huge emerald that I wore every day for the whole pregnancy. And I don't think I've worn it since she was born. I look at it, it's so beautiful, but it's for a different time in my life. And another thing that happened is that I had a spectacular sapphire from you and it was stolen. I was so heartbroken, devastated, I mean beyond, really like sick. And you changed my mind about that and you said it wasn't meant for you, it wasn't meant to be with you, it's the right thing for it to not be there.
Yeah, I learned in Japan from some of my clients that in Japan they say when you lose something, is that something bad was supposed to happen to you. And you lost something to protect you. And I think that's a beautiful way to see something. When something has to go, it's no longer, it shouldn't have been part of your life anymore.
I think that. I mean, I don't miss it.
You don't miss it?
No, it was very beautiful.
Yeah, it was
I think you probably missed it. It was really pretty.
I still remember the stone. It was such a beautiful pale blue.
It was
very
so
similar
pretty.
To your eye. But I also think it's interesting how in different stage of our life, we want to wear certain colors and certain stones.
Mm-hmm.
Like I understand what you say about the emerald.
Mm-hmm.
And I have my phases where you can see me wearing all pink or
yeah.
I have my all blue, all pink, all green. And it's the same with the jewelry. It speaks to me.
Mm-hmm.
I had a phase when I was growing my business where I used to wear diamond.
I can't believe that. Yeah. Well, no, I do remember that, actually.
I mean, they were rose cut. They were very understated.
Yes, they were beautiful. But I do remember that.
And if you know a little bit about diamond is a stone which gives you power.
Yeah.
People of power love to wear diamond. It was like all the kings wore diamond. I think in France, even the royal family, they were the only one allowed to wear diamonds.
Huh.
because, you know, the powers had to stay in their hand. So that, but now you never see me wearing diamonds.
No, I haven't seen you.
No, it's not an energy. And I don't even like working on diamonds because it's so bright when you work on diamond that it's difficult to see all the different nuances. And so it makes you quite tired.
Interesting. Can we start from the beginning? Will you talk about where you're from and where you grew up? You have a very interesting childhood.
I was born in Libya in 1964. And I moved very early on to Lebanon.
And your father was in the energy business or he was a diplomat?
My father worked for the French government.
Yeah.
So that's why we travel. And we left Libya because of what was going on, Gaddafi coming in power.
Sure.
And then we moved to Lebanon. And a few in the 70s, we had the same problem. We had to leave Lebanon. So I think that's also shaped my childhood to the fact that I've had to leave every time a country. So my father was working for the government. And at the time, we thought, do we live in Baghdad or Beirut? But my father preferred for us to be in Beirut, which was supposed to be called the Saint-Tropez of the East.
Well, and Royer was there. I mean, it was...
I think it was a lot... it was a very fun place to be for my parents, that's for sure. And for us, it was great because we had you can be by the sea, so you can go swimming every day. And we could be skiing.
Yeah.
1 hour away, you can go skiing. So it was amazing. You can swim in the morning, ski in the afternoon. Okay. So that's quite exceptional. But I have to tell you a little bit about my family. I think I'm quite a mixture. My grandmother was Scottish, head of a Scottish clan.
I didn't know that.
And my grandfather is a descendant of one of the three musketeers, Porthos.
Yeah.
So, and I come from Gascony, and it's somewhere where I love to go. That's where whenever I need to, rest, I would go to the Gascony.
When you were little and you lived in Africa, would you come back in the summers to Gascony?
I would come back every summer to the southwest of France, not to Gascony, because when my grandfather was alive, we would make too much noise. We were three girls.
Three girls and a boy and Pierre.
Very noisy. And I think he was an older gentleman and he didn't like us to be there. So we would just come and visit. But the day he passed away quite young, so my father inherited the family house and we would go every summer.
I know you have a complicated relationship with living in France. I think mostly because of the light, I think it's hard for you.
I have a complicated relationship with living with Paris.
Yeah.
It's interesting, but not so much France. I love the country in France. You know, when I was a small one, we would be in France. Summer was like a very happy time. We would have a long holiday and I'd be with my other grandmother on my mother's side, who was a beautiful woman.
Yeah.
And her mother was also an incredibly elegant woman. So I think I learned a lot from them. And we used to fancy dress a lot. My older sister, Sophie, who eventually was Comme des Garçons PR for a long time, when I was age maybe 5, she would organize fashion show when fashion wasn't so, prêt-à-porter was probably just starting, and she would, so we would fancy dress with all the beautiful clothes of my grandmother that we trash. When I think of it, I'm like so upset that they let us play with all the beautiful bias cut Vionnet dresses. But anyway, that was part of learning about fashion, and we would do fashion show, and that was our bigger event.
Did your mother and grandmother wear jewelry?
My grandmother wore a lot of jewelry, and my mother, she had some jewelry from my father's side, and she. What was interesting again, growing up in the early 70s, is that people were more creative, so they would go. My mother would go to her dressmaker. And she would get her dresses made, which was fun, which you learn in Beirut, and she would be out every night. And she would also go to the jeweler. Mm-hmm. So one of my first memory of stone is going to the jeweler in Beirut, where probably my mother was taking a stone out from a ring to get another different ring made more up to her taste. And the jeweler gave me a little sapphire and a little ruby. And I was so excited. And of course, I love them. And then afterwards, I lost them because they were so tiny. But so that's one of my first memories of jewelry. And the other memory of jewelry that I have is when they went to Iran. And again, it was before the revolution. So the treasure of the Shah of Iran was exhibited at the time. And they brought back all the postcards. of the jury, and I remember every single piece. And I mean, to this day, if I see a picture from the crown jewels of Iran, I always know where it's from.
How interesting!
And that probably started my love. That and my mother's mother, my grandmother, who was always really into her jewelry. She would always have like a, she had a big gold bracelet with lots of coins, a coin for every
place she visited.
For every year of her, she had five kids, and she had 19 grandchildren. So every kid had a,
The way it sounded.
Yeah. And the way it sounded. So for me, jewelry.
Because that's one of the first things I remember about you is your bangles. Yeah. And the way they sounded. And you had the bell and the one. Yeah.
So I think sound in jewelry is really important too. So I could hear my grandmother coming even before she was there because of the bracelet.
Exactly. You're one of three girls and a brother. All of you are creative, I think.
Me and my two older sisters, we really grew up together. Mm-hmm. And then by the age of 25, my mother had three daughters. Mm-hmm. And then for 10 years, she stopped, and then she was 35. She was like, "Oh, I would love to have another baby." So she had my sister Victoire, and then my brother Pierre 5 years later. So in fact, it's a bit like two family.
Yeah.
And at the time I was, we were growing up, we were lucky to be in Paris, and the fashion was very exciting. Mm-hmm. And my elder sister started working for Kenzo early on, but she was more on the PR side. And then Gabrielle was working for Willie Smith, another brand.
Wow. Yeah. He's from South Carolina, I think.
Is he? Yeah, that was quite incredible. And I went, I was fascinated with jewelry. So I went to London early on to study English. At 17.
17.
I wanted to study at the GIA in New York. And of course, I enjoyed London fashion so much that I stayed back for 10 years.
You loved London. I mean, you worked for very interesting people. Tell me about that.
I had an English course, which of course I hated. I thought the people in the class, especially coming from London, I thought, you know, that it was in Victoria and it was really depressing. Mm. And so I met Nikki Butler from Butler Wilson.
Yes.
And we just got talking, and within 5 minutes he offered me the job. And he said he'd never done that to anyone in his lifetime. So I started working at this amazing costume jewelry store, where everyone would come in. We'd have Faye Dunaway, but we'd have Princess Diana. We'd have we had the most amazing. We had the Ray Petrie and the Buffalo Boys and Nick Kamen, and he was friendly with everyone, and it was a great crew. So I loved working for him. I learned a lot about jewelry then, and I would be wearing a lot. It's at that time that I met Hamish, and Hamish in my book, he said that I was the first chic person he met. And I think there was a contrast between Paris and London, and in Paris, you know, it was quite people would really dress up, but in London they didn't. So I was coming with my French style to London,
and you never wavered. I mean, you stuck with it. I mean, I think probably traveling so much as a child, you were very sure about who you were.
No, I think I was not confident, but I believe Bill Cunningham says that fashion is the armor to survive the reality of everyday life.
Yeah.
And for me, it's something that I do all the time. I think I'm quite, I don't like having attention on myself. Fashion is my form of expression, and it's a form of protection also. Mm-hmm. So when I was younger, I think I would people would not dare to approach me. They thought I was very confident. I was not confident at all, but the clothes were like a protection.
But they say so much about who you are. I mean, I fell in love with you the minute I saw you.
When did we meet her?
It was in your old apartment, right on the Tuileries.
I fell in love with you too. You were so wonderful, such a good style.
For Philip Tracy too.
I work for Philip Tracy,
which I think is pretty interesting because I think it's that sort of around the face and it's sort of similar to jewelry, really.
Sculpture, very sculptural. Yeah. It's when I worked for Philip that I thought I really want to do something that I'm very passionate about. Mm. I would come in the morning, and Philip is slightly younger than me, and he was just out of the Royal College of Art, but he was already designing. I think he was designing for Chanel when he was at the Royal College of Art. Then he was designing for, he did Valentino, Versace. He would do everyone. Mm-hmm. And I would come in the morning, and he'd work all night. And I would discover the most amazing hats. And I just thought, I want to be as passionate as him. I want to find something. So if eventually, after working with him for maybe a year and a half, I decided that I needed to take some time off to decide what would be my passion. Would it be jewelry? Would it be textile, which is another thing I love, or design? I have a lot of friends in the designer world.
And you worked with Lucien Pellet-Fenet, did you?
I worked for with Lucien once when I took my sabbatical.
Okay.
Yeah. Lucien is a friend of my uncle, and I met him when I was 14.
In London?
In Paris. In Paris, in Gascony. He came to stay with us in the summer. Huh. And we got on very well instantly, and he used to send me for Valentine. He would be designing jewelry,
yeah.
And he sent me some jewelry, and it would be like be my Valentine. And I was 14, and you know, I don't know, he's a bit older than me, but we just connected always. And so he helped me at the beginning. I helped him when he started his brand. He started his brand when he was 50. And I was
really?
There, yeah. And I was there to do the selling with him.
Yeah.
And he thought that he didn't have a good color sense, because Lucien has an amazing color sense, but it's very bright, and everyone has always told him that he had a bad color sense. But
because I think that's the most beautiful thing about his sweaters.
Exactly. And at first, the first collection was navy, beige, white, and black, because he was frightened.
Huh.
And then eventually it came out of him and he did the most beautiful colors. So I was doing the selling for him. And when I did my first collection, eventually when I decided to actually finally, you know, go for it and make a, you know, show my creative work, I showed him the collection and he was the first one to say, I want to show it with my sweaters.
Oh, wow.
So he invited me to be in his showroom, and he used to be staying in this amazing apartment, Rue de Rivoli. Mm-hmm. And it used to be Madeleine Vionnet's apartment.
Wow.
And I wonder if Louise de Villemorin, there was a connection with Louise de Villemorin also on that place. So I showed the collection to Barney's, that was in 96.
Yeah.
And my first order was $120,000.
Wow.
I was so, I fainted when it came by fax, because at the time we were still working in fax.
You decided that you needed to pursue something that you were passionate about, but you didn't know what it was yet.
I always had a love of jewelry. And if you speak with my sisters, they would tell you that they always knew I would do jewelry. I wasn't sure if it was going to be jewelry or textile, or I knew I wanted to work in Asia.
Yeah.
I had been to India in 89, and that had left a very strong impression on me. And I had actually made a few pieces of jewelry when I was there in 89. I was a jeweler in Jaipur at the time. And we were supposed to stay in Jaipur just for 2 days. And in fact, we stayed a week, because I love the city.
Yeah.
And we stayed in the hotel, which is where I live now.
Wow.
Which is quite,
really?
It's like a full circle. India, for me, keeps me on my toes.
Yeah.
Because they have a different way of seeing life. And many times it's very surreal. You know, I laugh a lot. I mean, when I see before Eid, they are taking the little goats, and they're actually taking the goats home on their bicycle. So they're carrying the goats on the handlebars. The first time you sing, like, I'm sober today, but why am I seeing everybody carrying a goat on the bicycle? And this is one of the, you know, it was for Eid. And then eventually you learn. But everything, I think life can be so hard, because, of course, many people are, you know, living below the poverty level, that they really celebrate life every day. Because they don't know what's happening tomorrow. So that sense of joy is there a lot, and especially in the celebration. So if you've ever been to India for a festival, be Holi or be Diwali, or those are very special moments. So I fell in love with India, but don't forget, I grew up in Lebanon.
Yeah.
And there is this warmth of the Arab country. There's an incredible hospitality, which I found very difficult when I moved to Paris, because I was so used to in Beirut, but same in India. You know, you are with friends, and you said, oh, you're supposed to go to someone's for dinner. And you said, you know, I've got five friends. Can I bring them? In Lebanon,
in India,
they would
that's
say yes.
Normal, yeah.
In India, it's normal.
Yeah.
In Paris, you know, it would be like everything would be so...
it's not possible.
It's not possible. It's not possible.
Which is their favorite thing to say.
Yeah. No, the French like to say, non. 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 Non.
C'est pas possible.
C'est pas possible.
That first time you were there for the week, did you meet Manu there? Or not did you go 89. To visit the Gem Palace then?
Not in 89. I met Munu when I did my sabbatical and I traveled in Asia. I traveled in Asia to see all the different crafts. So yeah. I spent a lot of time in, I was in Thailand. I was in, I started in Japan with Philip Tracy. We did the first show in Osaka. And then I traveled around Asia. I spent a lot of time in Bali, which I love. And but I wasn't excited about the craftsmanship. It's only when I walked into the Gem Palace in 1996 and I saw the stone cutting room that I thought this is why I understood. And Munu was someone who really wanted to change the vision of jewelry. I mean, even so, he was such a brilliant designer of classic Indian jewelry. He wanted to change and make the craftsman evolved. I could see that it was possible and it was interesting for him to do something different. Mm-hmm. And he was already doing something different on his own. And with me, he got excited because the concept of the jewelry was different.
And tell me about your life there. How much of the year are you there and what's it like?
I spend about 3.5 months of the year there. Not enough. I would love to spend more. Mm-hmm. But my son is in school in Paris, so I have to share. And I live in an amazing old hotel, which is Nord Palace. Mm-hmm. So I start the day with, sometimes I have peacock on my terrace, which is so beautiful. Then I go down, they have a swimming pool, so I go swimming in the garden and there's going to be monkeys and parrots and the noise also. There's so many birds in India. I love the noise of the birds. So that's like my peace of the morning. And then I go to the workshop and I have this table which is covered in gems and I spend all day.
And you sit on the floor.
I sit on the floor. We have a, we work the traditional way. We have mattresses because if the stone fall, you don't want them to break. So we have white mattresses, white sheet. You don't want the color of what's around you to take away from the stone. So everything has to be white. It looks like a lab in a way.
Yeah.
And I have this table covered of stones. And Munu always used to say that when I was around, I would bring color to the room.
Yes.
Because I work with a lot of cold stone, which not everyone does, and this is my passion. And I also remember when I first started doing my jewelry and, you know, choosing all the stone, he said, you know, but Marie-Hélène, is it really what you want to do? You want to choose every stone? And I was like, yes, this is what I love to do. And it's a very meditative work, I think. I think you just spend time trying to find one stone which is going to make the next stone more beautiful. Mm-hmm. And it's something, there's not an answer because, you know, it's not like when you do puzzle and you've got to find the right piece. It's more like doing a painting. Mm-hmm. So it's something I really, really love doing.
I know that you inspire the workers too. I mean, I think that you've probably changed the way they think about things because it's a different way of working.
I think I challenge them because I don't come from a family of jewelry. Mm-hmm. I don't have preconceived idea of what's possible or not. Mm-hmm. And I'm always trying to push them to do something different. I started with a briolette, and at the time nobody was calling briolette in a semi-precious stone. It was diamond and emerald and rubies and maybe sapphire, but it wasn't heard of. Mm-hmm. And I always loved the Indian technique of drilling stones because it meant the stone is free. Mm. And I'm quite a free person. I always say that my biggest luxury is my freedom.
Yeah.
And so I think the craftsmen, they enjoy it. Also, I believe in life, if you're very passionate about something and if it's very important to you, then you pass on this passion to the people around you. Mm-hmm. In Japan, when I did the events, many times I've worked all night on the setup of the exhibition.
Yeah.
And I think the craftsmen who were working there, helping, you know, they were amazed, but they were so happy to do it because then it means their work is worth something that people are appreciative.
Yeah, I do think India and Japan have such a different reverence for work and craftsmanship than anywhere.
Yes,
and you have such a huge following in Japan, I know. You have stores there.
Yes, I have. So it's interesting because in Japan, they have this theory of the living treasure, and they really cherish the craftsmanship. And I think the craftsmen, probably do the same piece again and again, and they're so rigorous, and they believe they become masters when they're much older. In India, they also have amazing craftsmanship, but they don't, they love, they're very creative. So sometimes I would get them to do the same piece which I've done all those years, and it comes out and it's completely different. And sometimes it's fantastic and sometimes it's a disaster. But I think they have it in them. They are a very, very creative culture and they love decorating everything. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's a pleasure for a creative person to work with them, because they have an input. Mm-hmm. You know, you've seen how they decorate their trucks, they decorate the front of the house, they decorate anything they like to embellish.
Clothes, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And that makes it exciting. Well, in Japan, it's more austere, mm-hmm. but it's just more about the perfection of things. Mm-hmm. Perfection, but they believe that, you know, the wabi-sabi concept that beauty is in imperfection, and it's something I believe too.
Do you have a favorite stone?
Oh, this is such a difficult question.
I know. It's like children.
I have a few favorite stones.
I have some favorites of yours.
I suppose the stone that I'm the most fascinated with is a tourmaline.
Oh, really?
Because there is if you look inside the tourmaline, for me, there is a world. Mm-hmm. It has amazing inclusion. It can be like little rainbows or glitter. So the extreme in the tourmaline would be the Paraiba tourmaline, which is a color I love because it's a blue lagoon. And I want to dive in I'm wearing a Paraiba today. It's my favorite stone. And it's always been, ever since childhood, my favorite color.
Really?
And it's something, it's, you know, the way it shines, it's amazing. I want to be to dive in it.
Yeah.
So tourmaline is a stone that I'm fascinated just because it's what's inside, but also because of all the different shades of color. Mm-hmm. It can be the most amazing yellow. It can be beautiful blue. It can be gray. It can be pink. And the other one, which also has amazing colors, and it's a spinel that we were talking about. So that there's two stone. But there's a third stone, which I love too, sapphire. It's like you do.
Yeah.
Sapphires. Again, the colors and the quality. I mean,
the range.
The range. What's inside the silk? It's so beautiful.
It is like a whole world, isn't it?
And emerald. Emerald. I don't use so much, but for me, the most beautiful stone is emerald.
So beautiful.
So beautiful, but it's so rare and so difficult to find. And it's really like water, and it's limpide would be the word in French. I mean, there's something very. It's like a flow, but maybe because it's green and green is nature. What I love is, I don't know if you've seen, I mean, you know, you have been wearing my little parrots. I love when I have the craftsman who out of a piece of stone makes coming to life an animal. You know, he's making the parrot and he makes a squirrel and he makes a panther. And I find that really amazing, the skill. It's something I would love to know how to do, is to actually cut the stone.
Yeah.
I never did it, but I think eventually one day I will not be so shy and I sit down at the wheel and learn from one of the guys to cut.
How did you get Westerners to understand or to appreciate inclusions and the imperfection? I mean, you're the first person I think I've ever seen do that. And
I suppose that my client could see the beauty that I could see inside it. I think maybe people were discarding them before. But
I don't think anybody ever did that before, though. Before you,
I think if you look, I was looking, like, for example, at Belle Perron, and I love her work. And if you look at some of the, even the jewelry that's on the cover, I think it's a big ruby necklace on the cover, mm-hmm. and the stone is so imperfect. The taste of the Place Vendôme, which is you know the high jewelry, right. became purer and purer and purer. The jewelers,
Belle Perron was a woman.
Belle Perron was a woman.
Yeah.
And she was the most talented jeweler.
Yeah,
and she really influenced everyone in the Place Vendôme, but. You have to remember that, the business of jewelry is very dependent on the clientele. We're dealing with the raw material that's so expensive that you have to design according to your clientele.
Yeah.
And in the 1920s or 1910, we had the Indian would come with their stones. Uh-huh. And if you look at the jewelry of that time or even a bit later, there's amazing jewelry. There's an exhibition now at the Musée des Arts Décoratifs about mm-hmm. the marriage of Indore, and he just had some amazing pieces designed.
Right.
So the stones were included. They didn't mind the inclusion. The stones were beautiful. I think what changed a lot in the jewelry industry was when in the 70s, mm-hmm. when the oil money came in from the Arab world.
Yeah.
And it wasn't so much about the design. It was about the value of the stones.
Right.
It was, again, a social status. And this is when if I look at the archive of all the big houses of that time, mm-hmm. the jewelry became not so interesting.
Right.
Because the stone had to be perfect. But before that, they would use stone which were imperfect and they would find a way to use them. Mm-hmm. So I think I just went back on what we always, what was always there is use stone for the beauty of them and not worry about the imperfection. I was talking to this friend of mine, Jill Wolf, who has a beautiful store in Geneva, and she's a real jewelry person. She was, I think she worked at Christie's and she worked for some big diamonds, big stone dealer. And they told her, the first thing they told her that if there is an inclusion, it shouldn't disturb the eye.
Mm.
So I think there are inclusion.
Or distract, yeah.
Distract. There are inclusion that I will never pass. And some which I find that is actually enhance the stone and make it more beautiful and more lively. And sometimes I find stone which are too perfect. And for me, they're so boring. It's like beauty.
Yeah.
You know, you can see a beautiful woman completely perfect, but there is no charm. And you fall out of love really fast. When there's something off, it's fascinating. And it's what you become more and more attracted to that. And it's the same for the stone.
Yeah.
That's why, in a way, I'm sad that now that the standard of perfection is so high in beauty, because it's everybody looks the same and it's not interesting. What's yeah. It's a difference which is makes it interesting. It's the imperfection.
You're here in Charlotte tonight. We're having a supper and with our clients, and also to celebrate the launch of your new book, Gold and Gems. Can you tell me about the process and what it was like?
So I felt it was time to do the book, because I make a lot of one-off pieces and the one-off pieces get sold very fast and nobody see them. So I thought it would be good for the people who love my work that they have access to pieces they've never seen. And also I felt I've been designing for what now over 23 years. And I see the younger generation, they think that certain things have always existed, but they didn't exist. You know, when I started jewelry, there's a lot of things which I invented, which have influenced in many ways the jewelry industry.
Absolutely.
And there are, you know, their origin comes from my work, but nobody knows about it because I'm not, I'm a small brand. I don't advertise. So I felt it was about time to actually show where things came from. And I really wanted the book to put things in there. Well, I mean, it would be historical context because it's only 23 years. But I did the book in chronological order of design, and I also put the dates of every piece, because it's something that when I look at someone's work, be jewelry or be art, I want to know when at what time they were thinking about this. This is why when we're talking about Belperron, it's fascinating, but you could say that about Charlotte Perriand's work. You know, there are people who are so forward-thinking. And I think it's always important to put a date to something. So that's one of the reasons I did the book. The other one is I really wanted people to have the courage to do their own passion and to read my story and to think, I can do it too. And for me, my greatest achievement is that a few of my assistants have started their own business. And it means that I made them think that it was possible to run a business as a woman and to manage and to be successful. And that's great. And I think more people need to pursue their passion because it's so important. We spend most of our time at work, and you have to wake up in the morning and you have to be happy to go to work. You've pursued your passion. I mean, you feel it when you're in the store. It's a very special store. It's very, the world, it's your world. It's very colorful. It's very happy. and it's making a lot of people happy.
Yeah.
And that, you know, when you share something you love, it brings a lot of happiness. And when you bring harmony to the world too, that I think is very important. So for putting the book together, for me, was like showing that it's possible to do what you want to do. And, you know, you don't have to, not everybody can like what you do, but the people who like it, they really appreciate it. They, you know, they are touched by someone who's trying to do something different and personal. Yeah.
Well, I hope you know also how much joy you've brought to so many people, to me especially. you've brought so much beauty and joy into the world. We're so grateful.
Thank you.
We always ask what the guests wore to the prom, and I don't think they had the prom in Beirut. At the French school, maybe they did.
I never had a prom. I remember the first party that I had to go to was my eldest sister. I think she had a ball on a boat in Paris. And how old was she? Was she 18? And we had to wear Laura Schley, my sister. And I know we were all wearing Laura Schley. It was in the 70s and I hated those dresses. So I don't like them now.
Have you ever talked to Jane Pendry about it?
No, but when she came to my house in the country, there was this amazing wallpaper, which was a Laura Schley. Mm. And she was so happy because it's something that she had worked on.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and she had really pushed them to re-edit it. And when she saw that the whole living room is made with her wallpaper, she was happy.
I love
it. Those dresses, no, I hated wearing my
Do you remember
Laura
what color? Schley. No, you hated it. Do you have a favorite? Do you have a favorite dress?
Do I have a favorite?
Probably a time when you felt most beautiful?
No, I suppose it's always the latest one. You know, then I wish it would that effect of being the favorite dress and make you feel so good would last. Mm. This is one thing I don't understand, and I wish I would be able to make it last longer. But there are some clothes where you feel like you're over the moon. And then, you know, a year later, it just doesn't work. And it's a shame because it was a nice feeling.
Yes.
Thank you, Marie-Hélène. Thank you very much. It was such a pleasure.
What We Wore is produced by Capital and Balto Creative Media. The original song, Someone So Enchanting, was composed and performed by Britt Drasda. What We Wore is a member of the Queen City Podcast Network, powered by Ortho Carolina. Find out more at queencitypodcastnetwork.com.